loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the U.S. media have taken a tough position against rapprochement with North Korea and the possibility for peace on the peninsula. Is this just a knee-jerk anti-Trump reaction, or is there something else behind it? Next, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt today will propose a rule that would establish new standards for what science could be used in writing agency regulations. This is a rule change long sought by conservatives who argue that only publicly available information should be considered in EPA deliberations. Then, a group of 109 retired generals and admirals have signed an open letter to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee asking them to reject the nomination of Gina Haspel as director of the CIA. The former military leaders say they are, quote, deeply troubled by the prospect of someone who appears to have been intimately involved in torture being elevated to one of the most important positions of leadership in the intelligence community, unquote. And then a 25-year-old Toronto man drove a rented van through a crowd of people in that city yesterday, killing 10 and injuring at least 14. Canadian authorities have not said what Eric Manassian's motive was, and police are not using the word terrorism. But that hasn't stopped social media platforms from exploding over the issue, saying that Manassian is a Muslim and calling for more controls on refugees and immigrants into both Canada and the United States. And finally, in a dramatic act of civil disobedience, 7 peace activists were arrested while protesting at the Kings Bay Naval Base in Georgia, where submarines capable of firing a world-ending barrage of nuclear missiles are stationed. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the U.S. media reaction to the possibility of U.S. DPRK talks. The U.S. media has taken a very tough position against the possibility of any rapprochement or détente with North Korea and the possibility for peace on the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about why the media in America is treating the possibility of discussions and negotiations between Trump and the North Korean leadership as some grim failure for U.S. politics and U.S. diplomacy. We're joined from Ottawa, Canada by Steve Gowans. He's a journalist and author of Washington's Long War on Syria. Steve Gowans, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for joining. You know, a lot of hand-wringing in the corporate-owned media. They seem very alarmed that peace could be breaking out in the Korean Peninsula, certain that if there's any sort of a negotiated outcome other than war, it would seem, that Donald Trump is being just taken advantage of by the wily North Korean leadership. What's your take on the media?
Well, I think that they're afraid that the South Koreans, if they meet and talk with the North Koreans, will conclude or are concluding that the problem is not the North Koreans, the problem is the United States. And they'll seek to conclude a deal with the North Koreans, which from the South Korean perspective will be beneficial because it will lift the threat of war, so they hope. But the South Koreans may agree to what the United States doesn't want and the U.S. media doesn't want under any circumstances, and that's the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the peninsula.
Yeah. I mean, when I was looking at CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post, I mean, each and every article has had a very negative tone about Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un. Again, these are media outlets that have been, you know, consistently against Trump, at least or unless he's maybe dropping missiles on Syria. But they really have a sense of alarm about it. I just wonder whether, you know, whether, as you're suggesting, maybe the U.S. feels that if South Korea and North Korea have some sort of detente or rapprochement or even a lessening of tensions between them, that the South Korean natural alliances will not be with Washington. It will be either with North Korea or perhaps with China.
Yeah, I think there's a fear that the South Koreans could drift into the Chinese orbit and out of the U.S. orbit, that the South Koreans will figure out that perhaps they're better off with a rapprochement with the North and with dealing with the Chinese. But also, I think there's this recognition that the talks are a break with the U.S. policy, which has been a very coercive one. You know, the idea of essentially forcing the North Koreans to their knees until they surrender. And now, perhaps they view, the approach to talks as one that's been manipulated by Kim Jong-un. And it's interesting to consider that it's been acknowledged that the North Koreans were pushing Washington, or had been for at least a year, to have some kind of summit, some kind of talk, and Washington pushed back and said, no, they're not interested, because they're pursuing this policy of this coercive policy of forcing the North Koreans to surrender. And then North Korea comes along and makes a summit offer to the South Koreans, which then puts the South Koreans in a quandary, which is, well, we can accept, but if we do, now we're departing from Trump's approach. But on the other hand, if we decline, we risk a chance of, you know, building on a thaw in cross-border relationships and getting South Korea out from under the threat of Washington precipitating a war on the peninsula. So I think from looking at this from Washington's perspective, one of their strategic errors was creating fear within South Korea that they're about to precipitate a war, thereby motivating the South Koreans to be interested in talking with North Korea and to accepting the overture that Kim Jong-un made to them.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And when you think about what's actually happened, it not only is the U.S. media, but the Trump administration, all of them seem to be following events rather than leading the events. I mean, you just think back to that, the beginning, the first day of the Olympics, where you had Mike Pence sort of icily staring out, arms folded, not standing up when the North and South Korean team came in together, and you had North Korean and South Korean officials in the entire audience, the entire stadium cheering. And Moon Jae-in had accepted, as you said, the day after Kim Jong-un's offer on January 1st for a summit. The next day, Moon Jae-in said yes. And the next day, the North Koreans said yes to another sort of reciprocal, synchronized measure, you know, again, affirming that they would march together at the Olympics and that there would be no other missile tests for a while, et cetera. The U.S. seemed like odd man out there, and the North Koreans and the South Koreans had developed so much momentum. And the thing that also struck me about it, and again, I don't think the American media is at all picking up on this, is that North Korea really has had a very well thought through diplomatic and military strategy over the past couple of years. And they weren't hiding it. They were telegraphing it. And on January 1st, Kim Jong-un of 2017, Kim Jong-un said, we're in the last stage of developing our ICBM capacities and our nuclear weapons capacities. At the beginning of this year, he said, we've done it. We've completed it. Now we've got what we need. And then made the overture to South Korea, thus allowing South Korea to say yes, when North Korea already had done what it needed to do to have a deterrent capability. In other words, it seems like instead of North Korea being a rogue, crazy, irrational country, it's the American diplomacy that's been so out, or strategy that's been so out of sync.
It has been out of sync. Certainly the North Korean strategy isn't a rogue or irrational one. I mean, even Washington will now acknowledge that the North Koreans have been coolly rational, as they put it. But the policy of forcing the North Koreans to surrender is certainly out of sync and doesn't seem to be a particularly effective one. This is one that the United States has been pursuing for since 1948, and it hasn't succeeded. At times, the CIA has predicted that North Korea's collapse was imminent. They predicted that for 2002. And of course, North Korea didn't collapse. They're still predicting it. It's not happening. And even the policies, or not the policy, the approach that it seems they're likely to take into talks with the North Koreans seem to be completely unrealistic, which is essentially, okay, you abandon your nuclear program right now, and then maybe we'll talk about some kind of rewards or concessions afterward. I think there's a fear as well in Washington that the talks between the North and the South are ones that are going to result in South Koreans siding with China and arguing that this kind of Libyan model where North Korea completely abandons its nuclear weapons is unrealistic. and push for kind of a phased approach for denuclearization, which Washington so far has been rejecting or say that it has no interest in talking about.
Steve Gowans is our guest. We're talking about the media coverage about the upcoming talks between North and South Korea, and especially the talks between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. We're running out of time. We have less than 2 minutes left. Here's another naysaying article. It's from the New York Times yesterday, Jane Perlez. China feeling left out has plenty to worry about in North Korea-U.S. talks. As the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un prepares for his meeting with the president of South Korea and the U.S., China has found itself in an unaccustomed place watching from the sidelines. And then Perlez talks in great length about how China is feeling bad about all of this. It seemed to me to be incredibly off the mark, but what's your take on that?
Yeah, I see it as off the mark as well. Rather than being irritated or bothered by what's going on, I think that the Chinese might look at this as being something that could have considerable benefits. Certainly, if we're talking about a peace treaty on the Korean Peninsula, I mean, that has an obvious benefit for China, but there are other benefits as well. If we talk about a peace treaty, then you also have to talk about the question of why there's a U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula. If you have peace between North and South, why do you need a U.S. military presence?
Indeed. And I think what Perlez is trying to suggest is that China feels that there will be a grand bargain, that the North Korea and South Korea will come together and it will be all under the aegis of Donald Trump's shepherding, and that North Korea will move in the direction of the United States. I think this is, again, just bad media coverage, naysaying, designed to sort of pour cold water on what might be a very, very historic moment in the Korean Peninsula. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Ottawa by Steve Gowans. Steve is a journalist and author of Washington's Long War on Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt today will propose a rule that would establish new standards for what science could be used in writing agency regulations. This is a rule change long sought by conservatives who argue that only publicly available information should be considered in EPA deliberations. Other EPA scientists disagree with that. Indeed, one EPA scientist told The Scientist magazine today, quote, "Without changes to this policy, it will jeopardize our entire pesticide registration and re-registration review process and likely all Toxic Substances Control Act risk evaluations. Of concern is that companies will contribute extremely valuable, extremely high-quality study findings to be used in policy decisions that do not get published," unquote. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Fred, at first glance, this doesn't look like any big deal, but when you think about it, it's actually a very important thing, a vast change in the way science and data is being treated at the Environmental Protection Agency. Can you explain to our listeners why this is so critical?
Yeah, I think you're right. At first glance, you'd say, well, certainly information should be open, and I agree with that. I mean, in general, you know, scientific information should be available to everybody. He's using certain ideas which don't seem to be, a problem, but using it in very problematic ways. And let me just give you an example. When they do health studies, frequently on people I'm talking about, people are given anonymity. That is, the actual individual's name is not given. It's coded so that in case, for some reason in the future, that person doesn't want the information released, it won't be released. So privacy is a very important aspect of it. And what they're asking for is complete opening up of all the data. And while in general I would agree with that, specifically when you're dealing with data in which people have been promised privacy, then it's very problematic. Another example would be with farmers here. Let's say in Vermont or New York, you ask them to cooperate on something that's going to reduce the loading of phosphorus or some other pollutant. They don't want the data that's collected from their farm to be used against them in a court of law. And so they will request, again, anonymity in the study. And that's really important in order to get the cooperation. Otherwise, people won't cooperate with you.
I'm looking at the Union of Concerned Scientists website, which in my private time I go to often. It's very well done. It's chock full of great information. And it says here that that just in the last 2 days, 1,000 scientists signed a letter asking Pruitt to abandon this proposal. It says here, the scientists said, quote, "This would greatly weaken the EPA's ability to comprehensively consider the scientific evidence, undermining the EPA's capacity to protect Americans from serious health threats." So this isn't just a political decision we're talking about. There's a real impact that's involved here, and the impact is in people's health and well-being. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I mean, again, while it's a nice sounding, as many of the phrases, and in some circumstances I might agree with them, the real purpose here is to give industry more leeway. I mean, that's really the purpose. That's what Pruitt is trying to do away with the environmental protection regulations and laws and let industry do whatever it wants to do. I mean, that's essentially his role in the administration.
It's not the first time in history, John, where science and scientific evidence, facts, run into conflict with the powers that be. For a long time, industry and political power, you know, just dominated. And if science got in the way, the scientists were just brutalized. Just think of Galileo, where he had to say, he had to recant his thesis that the Earth wasn't
flat. And that
rotating and moving.
That's right.
And he said, yet it moves, but officially he had to recant. I mean, this is a centuries-long struggle, but now we have this new kind of 21st century iteration of it.
And further to that, Scott Pruitt was on a local New York radio show yesterday. It's hosted by John Katsimatidis. He's a very, very prominent multi-billionaire real estate developer in New York, primarily in Brooklyn. I know John Katsimatidis personally. We're not friends, but I know him. He's a nice guy. He is not a scientist. So Pruitt said here on the on Katsimatidis' radio show on Sunday that that this policy change is, quote, "a way to let the public judge the data, the methodology, and the analytics behind any scientific analysis presented to the EPA as it drafts regulations." What does the public know about these scientific issues and regulations?
In the name of sunshine and daylight, we can finally make our own judgments about the validity of scientific studies.
And like Fred says, at first glance, that transparency is a great idea. At second glance, it's really transparency is not the issue here at all.
Right. I mean, that's exactly the point, that in general, yes, information should be open. How they did the experiments should be explained, and they normally are. In a scientific paper, so that somebody else, if they want to, could go to try to replicate it or duplicate it. It seems like something that who's going to be opposed to, but really the purpose is to clamp down on the use of scientific information in making regulations. I mean, that's really the purpose, because you'll say, well, this one, they don't release the information about who was involved with it because they promised them, privacy, and therefore, we're not going to accept it. Or this other one can't be replicated because it was a one-time event, like the spill in the Gulf of Mexico and the environmental effects of that. How do you go back and replicate that? What are we going to do, have another spill on purpose? I mean, it's just crazy.
In a piece in today's Washington Post, it says that House Science Committee Chairman Lamar Smith, who's a very prominent, very powerful Republican from Texas, tried to get legislation to change this internal EPA regulation just so if a Democrat becomes president, he can't appoint another EPA administrator to change it back to the old rules. He failed in both houses. because even Republicans, at least many Republicans, recognize that this is a terrible idea.
You mean poisoning the environment, destroying... What? John, you're going way out on a limb there.
No, it's true. I mean, there are, you know, there are Republicans who want to breathe clean air and want to drink clean water.
Shocking.
Imagine.
Well, there used to be quite a few of them. You know, there's just fewer and fewer nowadays.
Yeah, we have a situation where the EPA is really functioning as a way to squash science and to do it on behalf of big industry, to pollute more, to poison us more, to create even more climate change. And of course, they can't, Fred, they can't come out and say, look, our goal is to sabotage, obstruct science, and prevent the public from learning about what the science actually says. They can't say that because that's obviously would be rejected. So they have to find another argument, which is we want the public to know. We want the public to have all of the information. It must be public data. It's really for the public. It's for our right to not be hoodwinked by climate change advocates. It's really designed to protect people because, in fact, they can't actually say, they can't tell the truth here because it will be rejected. So it's all of this clouding and masking. So how do we, Fred Magdoff, how do we tell the truth? What needs to happen right now? Because left to their own, Congress isn't going to do anything really good. If anything, it's going to do something very bad.
Well, you know, it depends on the subject, in general, if you're talking about the environment. But some of it is just clearly observable for anybody that's got eyes, you know, or you just... If you want to find it out, you can find it out very easily. For some of it, it's more sophisticated, you know, research that needs to be looked at if you want to get the details or want to see exactly what happened. I mean, basically, the answer is keep yourself informed. Try to understand what scientists are saying. A lot of them are getting better at translating scientific language into everyday language that anybody can understand, which they should be doing, they should have been doing all along. You know, most of the scientists, listen, they're bad actors in every field, right? And they're bad actors in science. There's no question about it. Just as there are in medicine, just like there are in everything, in every walk of life. But most of them are good people trying to do good work, and they're trying to do accurate work as well. And their research needs to be gotten to the public in a way that the public can understand it. Just releasing data doesn't help the public to understand it. I'm not opposed to releasing data. I'm just saying what they're asking for is really not going to help the public. It's going to really inhibit the use of data that where privacy concerns are part of the experiment, or promises of privacy are part of the experiment, or they can't be reproduced. In other words, they raise the issue of reproducing an experiment, which is a valid question. There are experiments that are done that later it's found out they can't be reproduced, which raises the question: how good were they at the beginning? So that is a valid issue in science. I'm not denying that. On the other hand, there are experiments that can't be reproduced, like I said, because they just happened. It was like an accident, and you took advantage of an accident in order to see what happened to the environment. Well, you're not going to reproduce that.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont, by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and the co-author of two recently released books, What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A group of 109 retired generals and admirals have signed an open letter to the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee asking them to reject the nomination of Gina Haspel as director of the CIA. The former military leaders say they are, quote, deeply troubled by the prospect of someone who appears to have been intimately involved in torture, being elevated to one of the most important positions of leadership in the intelligence community, unquote. Brian, this letter was at least 5 weeks in the making. We know that there is a large group of retired flag officers who care very deeply about the issue of torture. Many of them were active duty at the time of the Abu Ghraib torture incident, and they have vowed amongst themselves that they would never allow something like this to happen again without trying to stop it or to force people who were involved in torture to face the consequences of their actions. That's what this letter is.
Yeah, and John, for our audience here in the Washington, D.C. area or other radio markets around the country or around the world who may not know, you actually played a really significant role in this opposition to Gina Haspel because you had an op-ed in the Washington Post, which started online about Thursday or Friday before it was published in the Sunday Washington Post. Everybody, at least in the Washington, D.C. area, which would include a lot of these folks, they read that article. They read that op-ed. It made a big impact. First of all, I thought the title said so much.
I wish I could take credit for coming up with the title, but the editor did, and he entitled it, "I Went to Prison for Disclosing the CIA's Torture. Gina Haspel Helped Cover It Up." And much to my surprise, my very pleasant surprise, my op-ed received 2.8 million hits online. And then in the hardcover Sunday print edition, another million people saw it. And the funny thing, Brian, is that I wasn't going to write anything about Gina Haspel for the mainstream media. I have a weekly column with reader-supported news, and I was perfectly happy to write something and just send it to them. But the Washington Post came to me and asked me if I would write something. They said they wanted between 700 and 1,000 words. I gave them 1,250. They took all of it, and then they put it online, as you said, the Thursday before the Sunday that it was released in the actual newspaper. It took on a life of its own. I spoke with one of the flag officers today who was a signatory on this letter, and he said that it was the op-ed that got this group of generals and admirals to thinking that they needed to stand together to oppose Gina Haspel. And so over the course of the next 5 weeks, which takes us to yesterday, they circulated this this letter, an open letter to the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they were successful in gathering 109 signatures, including, I would note, General Hugh Shelton, a four-star general, U.S. Army retired, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So these aren't nobodies we're talking about. These are major senior U.S. military leaders.
And John, from a moral point of view, it's not hard to figure out why people should be against torture. From an ethical point of view, from a human point of view. But from a military point of view, because the military routinely employs violence, all kinds of applications of violence, from a military point of view, these officers, these flag officers, why are they so opposed to torture as a technique?
Because they know that it is immoral, it is unethical, it is illegal. And for the purposes of gathering intelligence, it does not work. It's as easy as that. I mean, you know, so many torture apologists or torture promoters, torture supporters want to have this ongoing debate about how it saves American lives and it disrupts attacks. And that's just simply not true. There's no evidence that is the truth at all.
And when you think about the Geneva Conventions or the other rules, regulations, laws that have developed about war fighting, part of the reason that the different countries entered into agreements with each other about the rules of the road, how to conduct oneself with war or with prisoners.
Yes.
The making torture illegal was also because if one side tortured, the other side would feel completely entitled to torture. So it wasn't simply about morals and ethics. It's also about defending your own forces.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I've maintained from the very beginning of this debate that one of the things that torture does is that it acts as a fantastic recruiting tool for terrorist groups and other enemies of the United States. You know, there are so many people, and this is something I think most Americans either don't understand or refuse to consider. Most people in the world don't really have a position on the United States. They don't love us. They don't hate us. They don't really think about us until we bomb them. When we bomb their villages and we kill their relatives and we bomb weddings and funerals and we blow up their government office buildings and try to overthrow their governments and we talk about regime change, et cetera, well, then they have to take a position. Now, when we capture their compatriots and then torture them, and then we're clear about the torture, and then we try to convince ourselves and others that it's not torture, well, then they do take a position on the United States. And that position is usually that they want revenge and that they want to begin attacking the United States or attacking Americans. And so it's counterproductive. You know, we have a rule of law for a reason, because that's how civilized countries operate. We operate by the rule of law. And if you don't like the law, then you change it. There's a mechanism for changing it. It's called the Constitution of the United States.
You know, you were in the field after September 11th.
I was.
And you were part of the capture of Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah was the individual who was tortured regularly, but that came after he was a prisoner. And I want to read I want to read for the audience a couple sentences from your op-ed, John Kiriakou. And again, people can read the op-ed. They can go to the Washington Post and Google your name. And the title of this article is, "I Went to Prison for Disclosing the CIA's Torture. Gina Haspel Helped Cover It Up." Here's what you write in the first paragraphs. "I was inside the CIA's Langley, Virginia headquarters on September 11th, 2001. Like all Americans, I was traumatized, and I volunteered to go overseas to help bring al-Qaeda leaders to justice. I headed counterterrorism operations in Pakistan from January to May 2002. My team captured dozens of al-Qaeda fighters, including senior training camp commanders. One of the fighters whom I played an integral role in capturing was Abu Zubaydah, mistakenly thought at that time to be the third-ranking person in the militant group. By that May, the CIA had decided to torture him. When I returned to CIA headquarters that month, a senior officer in the counterterrorism center asked if I wanted to be trained, quote, in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, close quote. I had never heard the term, so I asked what it meant. After a brief explanation, I declined. I said I had a moral and ethical problem with torture and that the judgment of the Justice Department, notwithstanding, I thought it was illegal." John, talk about Abu Zubaydah. Again, you're talking about the morality, the ethics. And when I first interviewed you back when you weren't a co-host but a guest, I asked you, why did the CIA torture him? Why did they waterboard him 83 times? Why was the CIA torturing? And you said they tortured for torture's sake.
They did. They did. I've maintained that that was the truth from the very, very beginning. Let's get one thing out there. Abu Zubaydah was a bad guy. He was a bad man. He was not the number three in al-Qaeda, but he had worked alongside al-Qaeda. He was responsible for running al-Qaeda's safe house in Peshawar, Pakistan, called the House of Martyrs. He was the founder of both of al-Qaeda's training camps in southern Afghanistan. And he was something of a logistician for al-Qaeda. If you were tired of the fight and wanted to go home, it was Abu Zubaydah who would get you a false passport and an airplane ticket. So certainly he was a bad guy. He was not the number three, and he was not the bad guy we accused him of being. One of my friends and I co-authored a book together, Joe Hickman, and I wrote a book on Abu Zubaydah called The Convenient Terrorist. And he was convenient because the United States needed a boogeyman. And as it so happened, there were two Abu Zubaydahs. There was the Abu Zubaydah that we captured, and then there was his first cousin who had the same name and who actually was a major player in al-Qaeda. Well, when he first realized that the CIA was after him, the FBI was after him, he ran away from the United States. He was living in Montana, if you can imagine such a thing. And he ran to Jordan, where he was arrested. Well, there was no reason to torture Abu Zubaydah at a secret prison. He was already cooperating with Ali Soufan, an FBI interrogator who had established something of a relationship with him and a rapport. But the CIA tortured him just for the sake of torture, because it made them feel better about themselves.
They waterboarded him 83 times.
83 times. And Brian, they did a lot of things that were far worse than waterboarding. They kept him in a cold cell, meaning that they chained him to an eye bolt in the ceiling so he couldn't lay or sit. And they chilled his his cell to 50 degrees Fahrenheit and then threw ice water on him every hour. They kept him awake for something like 9 days at a time. We know people start to die at day nine. They knew he had a fear of insects, and so they put him in a coffin for 2 weeks and dumped insects in there with him just to make him go crazy. So, I mean, that's not intelligence collection. That's not trying to gather information to save the lives of Americans or disrupt an attack.
Yeah, it's the Bouchery. It's the worst kind of barbarism. I mean, let's just call it. Gene, last question, real quick. We're out of time, John Kiriakou. Will this letter from all of these flag officers, I mean, more than 100, will it mean that Gina Haspel will not be confirmed?
I think that that is what's going to happen. I think that a lot of senators were looking for some sort of political cover to oppose her nomination and not have to pay a political price for it. I think this letter gives them that cover.
All right, we're going to leave it right there, John. We're out of time. That was John Kiriakou, the co-host of Loud and Clear. We've been talking about the nomination of Gina Haspel and the multifaceted opposition from so many different quarters to her becoming the next director of the CIA. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A 25-year-old Toronto man drove a rented van through a crowd of people in that city yesterday, killing 10 and injuring at least 14. Canadian authorities have not said what Eric Manassian's motive was, and police are not using the word terrorism. But that hasn't stopped social media platforms from exploding over the issue, saying that Manassian is a Muslim and calling for more controls on refugees and immigrants into both Canada and the United States. We're joined from Toronto by Chris Black, an international criminal lawyer who is on the list of counsel before the ICC. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Chris, I'm kind of active on these social media platforms, Twitter and Facebook, and I have to say that I have been utterly beaten up today. And I've been unfriended now by 7 people so far today because I've said that Eric Manassian is not a Muslim. But the more important issue is that it shouldn't matter what the man's religion is. If he did this, he's a killer and he's a terrorist. And it makes no difference whether he was a Christian or a Muslim. Have we gotten to this point as a society, both in the United States and in Canada, where it actually does matter if somebody's a Muslim? And that if there's an attack like this committed by a Muslim, it's terrorism. But if it's an attack committed by a white person, it's just a crime.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon which is taking place, that the role the Jews played in Nazi Germany is now being played by Muslims and Russians. If you're anything that happens is going to be blamed, there must be a Muslim or a Russian. It used to be there must be Jews. So the same sort of racism and xenophobia is developing, which is very dangerous because it leads down a very dangerous path. And as you say, there's no evidence whatsoever that he's a Muslim in any case, and I doubt that he is. And it looks like it's a matter of mental instability with this fellow, but nobody knows. So the Canadian government's now downplaying that. But they did make a lot of hay in the press and still are. Last night on most of the news networks, it was he may be a possible terrorist attack. Now they're downplaying it, but still ramping up the fear factor but these things can happen, you know, using trucks and vehicles. So we have to tighten up security. So there's, again, this installation of fear in the public and trying to justify tighter controls and all sorts of aspects.
Well, let's talk about tighter controls. Here, Chris, as you know, after September 11th, very shortly thereafter, October 26th, 2001, the Patriot Act was passed. Most people in Congress who passed it had never even read it, but it gave the government like draconian powers, including at that time, intelligence agents were going to libraries and demanding to see the book lists of what books had been checked out from public libraries. It was only the forceful struggle by librarians to expose it and to stop it in spite of the fact that they were violating or in jeopardy of violating gag orders. What's it like in Canada? Do you have a Patriot Act type piece of legislation that gives the government this kind of power?
Not quite as severe as that, but they did pass after 9/11. They passed similar legislation up here giving the security agencies increased powers, including the power to arrest and have secret trials. Detain people without charge just based on suspicion they may be engaged in terrorist so-called activity. But we don't have, I believe in the United States, habeas corpus for those types of offenses is still suspended, unless I'm mistaken. But here there's still habeas corpus. But they can still charge somebody with a terrorist attack or incident or even conspiracy or suspicion, hold them indefinitely and have secret trials. So, and they've increased surveillance in a lot of us. I've been a subject of that myself. So,
I want to ask you about that actually, because that's a huge issue both here in the States and in the UK as well. The UK is the most heavily surveilled society on Earth, and I've heard that the same is becoming true in Canada. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, an increasing number of people get visits from the security or intelligence service. I got one about 2 years ago. A very friendly chat. They wanted to warn me about things and suggested I'd be safer if I kept more of a low profile. But that's happening more increasingly. It's not as bad. I can't say it's as bad as what it is in the United States. I don't think it's that bad yet. But it is increasing, and there's the propaganda here against Russia and as Muslims. Russia particularly is phenomenal. I've never seen such intense propaganda. And it's very dangerous. The G7 was happening. Foreign ministers meeting was happening here over the weekend and ending today. And they're putting out communiques suggesting all sorts of new sanctions against Russia, increased security. And this incident with this event in Toronto, it gives them an opportunity to raise people's fears again about terrorism generally and insecurity generally.
That's interesting. That's a really interesting point that Chris is making, John, that even though the anti-Russia campaign, the Russia witch hunt is what we call it, is, you know, far different in one way on its face than, say, the campaign, the war on terror, or the campaign against Muslims. But when you create in society a sense of fear and foreboding that there are foreign powers or foreign entities that are coming to do you harm, and that they're always foreigners, they're either another religion or another nationality, another ethnicity, if you create this kind of fear, and the fear in a way takes on almost it becomes a religion. It becomes like an article of faith. You know, you just believe in it. And if you don't believe in it, you're maybe like, you know, going against the religion or going against your friends or your community or your neighbor. I mean, that's the inferno that grows and grows, and it becomes harder and harder to resist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think all of these things are tied together. There's a combination. I would add one more factor, which is, and Chris touched on it, is racism. If the people if the targeted entity or the people you say are targeting you happen to be people of color or Muslims from a religion that's not really the fundamental, you know, religion in the U.S. or the U.K., that also this creates this hysterical sort of framework in which every new incident, like let's take this one in Toronto. This is a crazy person who took a van and drove it into innocent people, killing so many, hurting so many. He's obviously an insane person, but the reaction isn't, hey, this is an insane person. The reaction is first and foremost, and the first and foremost is what leaves the lasting impression in people's yes. consciousness.
Yeah, and of course, as you say, the lasting impression is he must be a Muslim, whereas in, say, 1930s Germany, he would have been a Jew. Jews must be responsible. I mean, you can see where it's very dangerous, and it's the danger of World War is increasing more and more as it's developed, because you have the whole Skripal incident, all these, the Duma attack and the gas attack, so-called, in Syria, that just keep pumping out story after story to make people angry and fearful and wanting to take revenge on somebody for something somewhere. And why? Because I think they want people to stirred up to support a big war. There's got to be a motivation for all these stories being pumped out so quickly. They want to do something big.
And even if there's not a plan for a big war, all the events start to play upon themselves. A narrative is developed. The thing has its own life. So, Chris, in our last couple minutes, you've been politically active for a long time in Toronto, in Canada, also in the international arena. When you are evaluating the atmosphere politically now, say, compared to 10 years ago or 20 years ago, how do you think it's playing out in terms of consciousness inside of Canada? You were sort of suggesting that this propaganda campaign, either against the Russians or the Muslims, is really having a profound impact on how Canadians are thinking. Is that where it is? I mean, has it devolved to that?
Yeah, when the United States decided it was going to attack Iraq in 2003, there was a big demonstration in Toronto and Montreal. There was 250 to 300,000 people marching in Toronto against that war. Now there's nothing. And the anti-war movement has been taken over by human interventionists and responsibility to protect types. It's collapsed. I mean, there are some strong people and in groups, individuals, small parties. But the mass of people are watching really only the mass media, and that's what they're being peppered with, swamped with, bathed in every day. The Russians are doing evil things, and they've got to be dealt with. So programs like yours and independent journals have a big mission to try and counter that somehow.
John, Chris is right. I was just looking at a website for one of the U.S. socialist groups, a group that historically has always been out against the FBI or demonstrating against the Iraq war or anything. They're making the argument that should Robert Mueller, for instance, be fired by Donald Trump, and if there are demonstrations, the socialist movement in the United States should be in the streets protesting in support of Robert Mueller. I mean, here's the FBI. He was in charge of the FBI when the Muslims were being rounded up. Thousands of Muslims rounded up by the FBI under Robert Mueller, put into solitary confinement, not because of what they did, but because of who they were, because of religious and racial profiling. And now this socialist group says, oh, yeah, let's go demonstrate in defense of Robert Mueller against Donald Trump.
Right.
I mean, these people have lost their bearings.
Yes, they have.
If they had bearings.
Yeah, and I saw the Green Party in Germany today put out for the European Parliament a call to boycott the World Cup soccer games in Russia. They're trying to ruin Russia again, not let alone my soccer, all the soccer fans. But so that's where the Green Party is. The so-called progressive parties have all turned into pro-war parties like they did in World War One. You have the real hardline, the communist parties, workers' parties, still true to anti-imperialism. But the other left has really just gone over to the other side.
Yeah, it's gone over to the other side. I wish we could talk more about this, but we're out of time. So we were joined from Toronto by Chris Black. Chris is an international criminal lawyer who's on the list of counsel before the International Criminal Court. Stay tuned, Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a dramatic act of civil disobedience, 7 peace activists were arrested while protesting at the Kings Bay Naval Base in Georgia, where submarines capable of firing a world-ending barrage of nuclear missiles are stationed. We're joined in studio by Paul Magno. He is the finance director at Nonviolence International, a decentralized network of resource centers that promote nonviolent action and a culture of peace. Paul, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So tell us exactly what this action was. What did it consist of?
This was an action that took place at the Kings Bay Naval Base on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's martyrdom, and it was meant to draw attention to the threat that Trident nuclear submarines represent. Even within the nuclear arsenal that the United States maintains, it's the most treacherous and lethal weapon system of all. Kings Bay is the home port for 6 ballistic missile Trident submarines, and that means 3,600 Hiroshimas are headquartered there when they're not out to sea. These folks were conducted an action called themselves the Kings Bay Plowshares. This is one of over 100 plowshares actions that's taken place since 1980, where people of faith and nonviolence and conscience go into weapons facilities or military bases with the intention of bringing to reality the Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah. Beating swords into plowshares is an absolute premise for having a peaceful world.
You know, I'm wondering, too, I have friends who have participated in similar actions at military bases all over the country.
Right.
And the authorities usually respond and react with a very heavy hand. Federal courts even hand out real prison sentences.
Sure. I've had one.
Is that what you expect in this case as well?
These 7 folks prepared for this action with the expectation that they were, that was at least the minimum risk that they were running. you know, these are acts of, you know, these are nonviolent actions. They involve risk and sacrifice. They involve the kind of things that we think that are absolutely essential to confronting as existential an evil as nuclear weapon system, and the triple evils that Martin Luther King talked about that they wanted to call to mind, militarism, racism, and capitalism, are all a system of, you know, imperial violence that plagues the world. And we can't possibly confront them and overturn them without putting ourselves on the line.
You are on the line. So what actually, when you mentioned that you yourself went to prison, talk about that.
I was involved in a similar action, a Plowshares action of the same nature in 1984 at the Martin, what was then the Martin Marietta Pershing Missile Factory in Orlando, Florida, down the road from Kings Bay. And eight of us were arrested at that time for going into the base on Easter, on April 22nd, 1984, which was Earth Day. Easter and Passover all rolled into one calendar date. We were able to take hammers to Pershing missile components, pour blood on them, and pray in the yard as the sun came up on Easter Sunday. And for our troubles, we ended up getting 3-year federal prison sentences. And I served 20 months of most of that at Allenwood, Pennsylvania. And this action, that was one of the earliest of the Plowshares actions. It contributed to precipitating the negotiation of the end of Euro missiles confrontation between the U.S. and then the USSR. We got prison, and Mikhail Gorbachev got a Nobel Peace Prize. Go figure.
Yeah, indeed.
Similar, John, you got prison, and yeah. Gina Haspel got nominated to be the head of the CIA.
Yeah, I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I got 30 months at FCI Loretto, and Gina Haspel gets promoted to director.
Well, Pennsylvania is a great place for a long retreat.
Well, God knows there are a lot of prisons in Pennsylvania because the federal prison system really is an employment agency for otherwise unemployable, undereducated, rural white guys. That's what it comes down to. But that's neither here nor there.
Right.
We're here to talk about your peace actions.
John, just before, well, go ahead. And I want to ask a question about the Trident submarine, actually.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to do.
So go ahead.
Go right ahead.
All right. So when Donald Trump was at that time threatening to totally annihilate North Korea, he said, we're going to send the Armada. We're sending the aircraft carrier. He actually sent 3 aircraft carriers. And he said, and we're sending this submarine. He didn't say which one, but we're talking about the Trident submarine, Trident nuclear submarine. He said, and that's even more dangerous than the aircraft carrier. And he's not wrong about that, is he?
No, he's not. Let me just talk about Kings Bay itself. And there's a similar base in Washington State. But Kings Bay holds as home port to 6 ballistic missile Trident submarines and 2 Trident submarines that have been converted into guided missile submarines. Now, I'm entirely uncertain whether the 2 Tridents ported at Kings Bay were, because the government hasn't told us, but the Florida and the Georgia, which have been converted from ballistic missile submarines to guided missile submarines, I don't know if they were involved in the recent strikes on Syria, because they haven't said which military forces they used. All we know is they rained down death and destruction. But so those guided missile submarines are, you know, designed for a certain kind of theater warfare, getting close to a place and then unloading cruise missiles on Syria or Korea or on places like Lebanon and Libya. But the ballistic missile submarines are meant to, you know, you can strike your enemy target, if you want to call it that, say Russia, Moscow, or St. Petersburg, from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in half an hour with these, and they're very accurate, and they're first strike weapons. And, you know, every Trident submarine that carries these missiles is carrying 600 Hiroshimas with it. They say a submarine commander is the third most powerful man in the world behind the leaders of the United States and Russia. So they're the most lethal aspect of our nuclear triad and our nuclear arsenal.
So each submarine has how many, for the ICBM carrying missiles, how many independent multiple reentry missiles are they carrying?
It's changed over the years. I think at this point, you're carrying 24 missiles, each with at least 8 warheads. So a minimum of 172 warheads.
And these are nuclear weapons.
And these are nuclear warheads, absolutely the most precise nuclear missiles that there are in the ballistic missile arsenal.
When you were arrested and went to prison in the early or mid-1980s,
correct.
What were the targets, say, in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union? What kind of places were targeted with these hundreds of, or almost 200 or whatever the number was then, of nuclear weapons on a particular sub? What was targeted?
Well, Trident submarines, 35 years ago, say, could be targeted on cities or military sites or the like. And so maybe they targeted Chernobyl. Maybe they targeted the submarine pen that the Soviet Union had on the Pacific coast. Maybe they targeted Moscow or Leningrad. Or, you know, maybe they have such a variety of targets they can choose, and they have so many missiles that they probably target many of those sites redundantly many times over, so that you wouldn't have a single warhead hit Moscow. You'd have a volley of warheads obliterate
the
place.
And not coming just from submarines. They're coming from submarines. Yeah, they're coming from silos based on land in the United States. They're coming from fighter jets that are in the air and that are carrying them at any given time. It's talk about mutually assured destruction, huh? How do you survive something like that? You can't.
Well, you don't. Many, many years ago, experts as prescient and even questionable as Robert McNamara would tell you that you need 200 warheads, 200 missiles to destroy the planet. The rest is to stir the dust of the destroyed planet. Right. And we still maintain, I think, an arsenal of on the order of 15,000 nuclear weapons at the ready. Not to mention whatever might be in reserve.
We interviewed Daniel Ellsberg here not so long ago about his latest book, The Doomsday Machine, where he was talking about his time at the Pentagon and RAND Corporation as a nuclear contingency war planner. But he asked that question up to his up the chain of command: how many people would die if we initiated this nuclear war plan? Thinking that they hadn't done the numbers, but in fact they had done the numbers, and they got back to him right away and said, well, it's 600 million or 800 million, and that was the initial stage without talking about nuclear fallout, et cetera.
Right.
It's a staggering number. I mean, how do you go about your job of planning to kill 600 or 800 million plus people?
Well, you know, as I said, this action that our seven friends are presently in jail for is the latest in a 38-year string of nonviolent confrontations with the military system, and one of those was an action in Tennessee 6 years ago. Three folks went into the Y-12 nuclear plant, and when they went to trial, Ramsey Clark, Attorney General, who actually was part of the negotiating team for the Nonproliferation Treaty, gave testimony in court, and he absolutely insisted on the word omnicide for what we have prepared in the nuclear arsenal. And he also pointed out that this was 3 years ago. This was 2013 when the trial happened, that, you know, we don't have, despite arms control and arms reductions over the years, we don't have less lethal firepower in our arsenal than we did at the height of the Cold War. At the height of our arsenal, we have just as much lethal firepower at hand.
Something people should be considering when they're embracing this complete anti-Russia hysteria, because why is that a good idea? Let's have the two major thermonuclear powers, like, heat it up.
Yeah, heat it up and angry. We're going to have to leave it there, though, unfortunately. We were joined in studio by Paul Magno. Paul is the finance director at Nonviolence International, a decentralized network of resource centers that promotes nonviolent action and the culture of peace. And with that, we are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. And now you can follow us on Twitter at LoudClearRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.